Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome. This is Cup of Joe, part of Project Zion podcast, where we explore restoration history. And I'm your host, Karen Peter. Today's episode is one of our collaborations with Historic Sites, as we interview the presenters from the 2020 Historic Sites Summer Lecture Series. These lectures can be found at historicsitesfoundation.org. And our guest today is Dr. David Howlett, who is an historian, a professor, and an author. His work includes Mormonism, The Basics, which was co-authored with John Charles Duffy, Kirtland Temple, the biography of a shared Mormon sacred space, and that came out in 2014, and he has many other texts as well. Dr. Howlett is also a member of the Community of Christ Church History Team, and we appreciate that service as well. So welcome, David.
Glad to be here today.
So you've been on Cup of Joe before, and we actually received some really positive feedback from your discussion on the church's expansion into India, which was marvelous. A lot of conversation about the way the church handled the polygamous tribes of India. That was new information for some younger Community of Christ folks, and that was very interesting information for some of our friends from an LDS background. So thank you for that interview.
Happy to share.
So today's lecture is on the Historic Sites Summer Lecture Series on the Community of Christ going into the Philippines. That's what we're going to talk about today. So first, why has the global expansion of Community of Christ been of interest to you? India was an area of interest and study for you, and the Philippines. What made those of interest for you?
So scholars are supposed to give an answer that's about some kind of driving question that they have, that they thought about, and they realized these subjects would be just perfect to study that question. But the reality of all research projects are much more mundane or even serendipitous of why people study something, and they're often somehow personal. In this case, it was the fact that in 2014, then Apostle Andrew Bolton, who was the apostle in charge of Community of Christ, overseeing that in Asia, he came to me with the idea of going to India and collecting oral histories of the church there in preparation for their 50th anniversary. And then he asked me the next year, what about going to the Philippines? Because their 50th anniversary would be the next year. And I said yes to both. And so that's what began this process. You know, the scholarly answer goes something like this. There are great ways to which we can illustrate the global reach of American denominations in the late 20th century, as well as thinking about how global Christianity is not just centered in one place, but it's about interconnections between people in many places. And I do believe that a truly global history of Christianity has to take it into account, not simply like a history that's localized, but a history that is expansive, because people are involved with peoples in many other places through structures like NGOs, church denominations. I mean, you can go down the line, but Christians have global affinities that go beyond the nation state. And honestly, studying Christianity elsewhere outside the United States is also helps you understand something about Christianity in the United States, because there are connections between all of these places. So that's the scholarly answer for why studying the Philippines and India.
I like your scholarly answer voice too, when you purposely began with that. Yeah, that's fun. So there are these increasing connections. We're seeing it even more now during COVID, because we are all connecting online and people are discovering that we can connect with one another around the globe in ways we never even thought to do before.
And I think that that's one of the kinds of results of, you could think of it as globalization is about the intensification of connections, which have been happening for a millennia. Christianity has always been connected, but what we're seeing is an intensification in the late 20th century, which Community of Christ presence in the Philippines and India illustrates, but also we're seeing how that continues today with a further intensification of those connections.
So let's talk a little bit about the church in the Philippines. The official organization of the church in the Philippines is 1966. But looking at your work, I see the story does not begin there. So when does it begin in the Philippines?
Well, if we take the perspective of the Philippines church and of folks within the Philippines church, when they narrate their church history, and there are church histories in those who are researchers want to find in the archives, they often will start with stories of two men. Some accounts say they're cousins. They might be second cousins. They're not directly cousins, but they might be second cousins. And they're good friends. They're both from the same area in the northern island of Luzon. So Luzon is the island where Manila is, if folks can picture that in their minds. We'll go far north of that, and you'll get to an area like San Manuel and Binalonan. These are towns. Well, these men were from those towns. And they came to the United States in the late 1920s as part of this kind of intercolonial labor system where American immigration policy had become extraordinarily restrictive in the 1920s. It almost ended all immigration to the United States from Asia, from Southeastern Europe. And that also meant that farm laborers who often were from Japan or from China on the west coast of the United States were no longer able to get visas if they weren't already within the United States. Well, the United States is an empire. It's always been an empire in some ways. And what's part of that empire? Well, the Philippines, the Spanish-American War. So what happens then is that sugar corporations in Hawaii, corporations in the United States, truck farms, things like that, are able to import labor to the United States from the Philippines. And oftentimes, these are young men in their early 20s who leave from rural places, who leave their rural villages, and they come to the United States, and they work truck farms or in sugar plantations, in the case of Hawaii, and they begin creating communities there, too. You can talk about Filipino Seattle in the 1930s, for instance. These two men were part of that process, and they were in, for a good amount of that time in the 1930s, in Oregon. And while they were in Oregon, one of them, Potenciano Carino, joined an Adventist church that was there. This wasn't the Seventh-day Adventist. This was a much smaller church called the Church of God Seventh Day, just as old as the Seventh-day Adventist, but different. They like reject Ellen G. White's prophecies, for instance. But what's significant about this church in terms of its belief structure, which would have an impact later on in this and the story related to Community of Christ, this church had undergone a reorganization in the 1930s according to what they called a biblical plan. That meant they had apostles and 70s. And they had dietary constraints, like Adventists do as well. They maintained the headquarters for their church was Jerusalem, Israel. So Jerusalem figured prominently in their theology, and they thought of themselves as restoring an ancient order of things. So Carino joined that church, and he even, in this time period, married an American woman. He moves to Los Angeles. He's still part of the church. His wife passes away, unfortunately, in 1937. The next year, 38, he's back in the Philippines. But back in the Philippines as the leader of the Church of God Seventh Day, which basically means you're in charge, now start a church. And he does. And he creates a network of congregations in small villages. And meanwhile, his good friend, Benito Malawat, who had been with him in Oregon, marries an RLDS woman in Los Angeles, actually, or the area. So I don't know if Benito Malawat actually went to Los Angeles, but that's where she was from. And he joins the RLDS church. And by the 1950s, he's a barber in Independence, Missouri. And there in Independence, he begins writing again to his friend Potenciano. And they correspond for years, actually. And Benito is trying to evangelize his friend Potenciano. So he sends him tracts. And over time, Potenciano's like, well, he talks about this with his fellow ministers. They have long conversations about this, according to Maximo Cabita, one of his fellow ministers in the Philippines. And so by then, the mid-1960s, they make contact with RLDS ministers after writing to Independence. And a 70 Dale Bethel first visits them. He was in Japan at the time. And then later on, two apostles, Charles Neff and Clifford Cole, visit the conference of the Church of God Seventh Day when it's meeting in Binilonan, Pangasinan. So that's a beginning point, really, for Community of Christ in the Philippines. It's a long way of saying it comes through a friendship that spans, it's a transnational friendship that spans decades between two men that results in a network of friendships that results in congregations, actually. We can continue with that, but that's the beginning of the story, at least.
So before we go into when the two apostles go to visit, as a 70 myself, I need to, you know, give a shout out to Dale Bethel, since he was the first RLDS person to go in and to visit with them in person as he came from Japan. When you talk about the labor, the import of labor, that's a really helpful piece to understand if you are interested in the history of the church on the West Coast. When you look at photographs of the church in the major West Coast cities from the 40s and 50s, you will see a sea of white faces and a lot of Filipino faces in the church in Seattle, in California. I haven't seen those kind of photographs from the Portland area, but I would guess the same in those major areas. And this helps us understand why that is on the West Coast.
I would love to follow up on learning more about that myself. So those are great details. So maybe local congregational histories would have that. I don't know of any historical works that have actually studied that. So people who are listening, so if you would like to study that, that would be a great contribution to understanding our church history and putting this in a wider context about immigration, labor, labor rights, labor lack of rights. All of that is related to this kind of like conversation too about church belonging.
So let's go on then to the two apostles go to the Philippines. So we already have established contact through Dale Bethel, personal contact. We have people who have been discussing the church for some time, one a member and one a pastor of a and leader of a network of congregations in this Adventist denomination. So the two apostles go. Let's talk about them, who they were, because they're both pretty recognizable names for Community of Christ folks, but if you don't have a long-time history in Community of Christ, they might be unfamiliar to you. Let's talk about those two folks first, and then kind of how they entered the story.
Yeah, I should also say that there is contact before Dale Bethel, too, with RLDS church members who are working, who are either soldiers or sailors or somehow related to American military forces in the Philippines. Richard Guthrie, a doctor in Cavite Bay, or Subic Bay, Cavite? Okay, I can't remember. Subic Bay Naval Station visits them, for instance. But there's other GIs in the Army who will make contact with different Filipino individuals. And there is a small group in Manila of American expats and service members, which is a group that's more like a study group. It's not an established congregation. It's sporadically attended. It's only there as long as there are people stationed there. So it has no Filipino members at the time. So that exists also in this era before then. But this is really the establishment of the church in the Philippines, starting with the story of Potenciano Carino. That's really where the church really comes into being in the Philippines. Well, okay, back to Neff and Clifford Cole. So Clifford Cole is, for the history of community Christ in the 1960s, one of the more important figures to think about. He's the president of the Council of 12 Apostles. So in the LDS Church's quorum, in the community Christ, it's council. That's an old 1830s lingo there, Council of 12 Apostles. Well, Clifford Cole is grounded in Restoration tradition, but he's also certainly a progressive in the tradition that has ecumenical horizons in terms of his theology. So he's very open and would like the church to become something more than an American denomination. So he says this in an article in the late 1970s about what could be the future of the church in the 1980s. This is towards the end of his, you know, kind of apostolic career. And he basically says, you know, if we just remain an American church, we'll never be a welcoming church for anyone else except middle-class Americans. He said, we went from a church that was basically working-class folks to middle-class really quickly, but we're only going to be a middle-class church of Americans if we don't broaden our horizons for what we can be. So how can we welcome African-American communities, he says, if we aren't willing to actually be other than just middle-class white? How can we welcome, you know, anything other than just Americans in other places like the Philippines? I mean, he gives these examples of the church in Asia. So he has an orientation already where he thinks the Restoration Gospel can be something that's indigenized in other places, and that the Restoration Movement can become something different than what it was in the 1960s. So with that kind of orientation and a penchant for theological exploration beyond traditional RLDS theology, he reads a lot. That makes him open to the church's expansion elsewhere in different ways. And Charles Neff, too, is very open to the church's expansion in new forms and new ways. Charles Neff, along with another man who will become later on an apostle, Sakine, so Kasune Sakine, who is in Japan, both are early advocates for the indigenization of RLDS theology. And Sakine does this as early as 1957. He's advocating for this. And he's just a member at that time. He'll later become an apostle, but he's already talking about this in the Herald, about how, you know, the gospel in Japan, he says, we don't need a translation of the Book of Mormon. We don't need a translation of the Doctrine and Covenants. We need friendships formed across the bonds of like national borders that demonstrate somehow a Zionic ideal. So already he's thinking about it has to be different in Japan. And actually Sakine advocates for that pretty clearly in this Herald article from 1957. Neff also becomes an advocate for indigenization in part through his own experiences in Japan, seeing that the older 1950s RLDS kind of formulation of the gospel, where Jesus Christ built his church and it has these things and we're not LDS and this is why LDS are wrong. And that kind of formulation doesn't work at all in Japan. Like, no one cares. So it's like, what are you talking about? So for Neff, he comes to think that the gospel has to somehow be indigenized, that the seed can be planted and that it grows up in its own, in the soil of like Japan. And it grows up in its own way, but the seed of the gospel has something in common with the seed of the gospel elsewhere, but it's different too, growing in different places, in different soils. Indigenization is not something that Neff or Sakine invent. It's rather a bigger trend in global Protestant Christianity at this time. And when you look at the language that Sakine and Neff use and talk about, they're definitely being influenced by people like earlier Protestant indigenizers from the 1920s. And they continue reading these indigenizers in the 1970s too. Some of them are Catholic, most are Protestant, but they make these arguments for a truly global Christianity. It has to be not colonial, but it has to be somehow anti-colonial. And if it's going to be anti-colonial, it has to rely upon indigenous leadership. It has to allow for some indigenous expressions of the gospel that are different than the colonizers' expressions of the gospel. And it has to be linked somehow in terms of given some kind of like autonomy to an indigenous church too. So those ideas about indigenization predate the RLDS movement and the wider kind of Protestant milieu, but they're also being embraced by many Protestant churches at the time, like the Methodists, who have a very strong indigenizing impulse in terms of what Methodism looks like outside of the United States in the 1960s. And it is, of course, in also a context of a post-colonial environment across the world where suddenly people are thinking, well, maybe colonialism wasn't so great. And then the question of what comes next after colonialism, how were churches complicit in colonialism? What do churches do now? Those were questions churches in Christianity, who we might call ecumenical churches, the more liberal Protestant churches, were asking. They were also questions that RLDS folks began asking in the same era.
So as you're talking about indigenization and anti-colonialism, which I think is fascinating at this period of time when we're learning what anti-racism is, that it's in the same vein. There's a wonderful novel I read a long time ago called The Poisonwood Bible, which kind of lives out this idea of colonialism, Christianity versus indigenous Christianity. So if you haven't read that, listeners, that would be a really good fictional study of what David is talking about. So Neff and Cole were the two apostles who first officially entered into our story of the Philippines here. They both had this way of understanding the church and its place in Christianity as moving towards a broader expression of the global reality. What happened when they first went there?
So the interesting thing is that while in a place like India, arguments about the one true church make no sense. For like Sora folks, while in Japan, arguments for the one true church make no sense. In the Philippines, it makes sense suddenly. So here's the ending of it. So, well, the Philippines is the most Christian country in Asia. And while the Philippines was not a denominational society like it is today, in the 1960s, there were plenty of Christian denominations and smaller groups that were more sectarian all over the Philippines, especially Luzon. And we see that just the fact that we have then this very small Church of God Seventh Day based in America. And when I say very small, we're talking 30 congregations in the U.S. And then you have this branch in the Philippines with 350 members in, you know, multiple congregations. Well, that shows you that you already have a kind of denominational or sect, church sects kind of setting in the Philippines, at least in these areas, where there are lots of religious choices. And so folks like Potenciano Carino have a kind of scriptural literalism that they kind of adhere to for understanding how do you understand texts. They value the notion of church structures matter, and there's a biblical pattern. And there's this church from America that appears to have some of the structures they have, and they have beliefs which fit somewhat and have other beliefs that don't. So suddenly, the Bible, literal proof text, literalistic proof texting, and older RLDS arguments about RLDS truth suddenly matter to these folks. So what does Charles Neff do and Clifford Cole do, who are both probably at this point in their own theology thinking, maybe those aren't the most important things to talk about to people when we're evangelizing for the church, and maybe even these aren't the things we want to take with us into the future for the RLDS church. Well, Neff says in his memoirs that in Japan, he had a lot of colleagues who were Adventists. And Cole talks about knowing Adventists too. So he's like, yeah, he kind of got what they were talking about and knew how to talk to them because they'd had these conversations before with Adventists, not Church of God Seventh-day Adventists, but SDA, so Seventh-day Adventists, the larger church. So they got what was going on here. And, you know, they had frank conversations for several days. It was a conference. And some of the ministers were like, no, this is not right. They went back and forth with ideas like, you know, what day do you worship on? So, you know, Adventists, it's going to be Saturday. and not Sunday. Like the time of resurrection. I mean, Neff was like, what are we talking about? Like the actual time of the day in which resurrection happened. I mean, there were things like that they were talking about. Despite maybe some exegetical differences that Neff and Cole would have had with Carino, and in this case, it was Maximo Cabita was the secretary of the church. Both Carino and Maximo Cabita saw something in the RLDS church which they saw appealing. Neff later narrated it as that, well, he said, doctrine mattered to them, and they saw doctrines that they felt were commensurable in the RLDS church as was in the Church of God Seventh Day. They also saw that there was stability in the RLDS church. Mm-hmm. Church of God Seventh Day was extraordinarily fractious in the American manifestation. After Carino left in the 1930s, it kept splitting over and over again. It still exists in various forms. There are many various forms of it. There are never more than 7,000 people that are attached to it. The RLDS church, in contrast, looks very stable. Beyond that, too, there's a realization, I think, that both Carino and others have that, well, there's an opportunity to be a leader within a church, too, if they are affiliated with a larger church. And that's no small thing. So when you consider that most of these folks are, these are all farming communities, the villages they're from, and this provides a certain kind of stability for your family. It provides stability for your network of family, which extends to your cousins. And I mean, it's a way of like helping to establish that, these transnational relationships. So I think that's part of the appeal of the RLDS church, both the beliefs that are similar, and also the fact that it's way more stable than these other Adventist churches that are out there and still out there. And the other part, which makes this really appealing, the third part, Neff and Cole are already committed to indigenization. If that means that gives then the Filipino church more autonomy in terms of like, can they shape the church in certain ways? Do they have to give up certain things? Well, they don't have to give up a lot by becoming RLDS. So the one thing they say, like, the part they have to compromise on is the day of worship. They're like, yeah, you have to worship on Sunday. They're like, okay. But beyond that, things like, well, do we have to eat pork? They're like, no, you don't have to eat pork. I mean, things like that is like things that were important to Church of God mm-hmm. Seventh Day Adventists in the Philippines, like not eating pork or blood sausage, which are really popular in the Philippines, by the way. So for them to be able to still have those same dietary standards, that was important to them. And so the fact they had that autonomy meant something to them too. So I, talking with Maximo Cabita in 2015, and Maximo's now, he must be close to 95. He's the last surviving original member from the first group that was baptized in 66. So he says that basically he saw it as the Church of God Seventh Day and the RLDS Church as the same church, but with different tactics, which I think is a helpful way of actually summarizing that, of like, okay, they have different ways of tactical movement is different than strategic movement, right? Tactical, so different kinds of ways of moving around and doing things, but they're basically the same church for him. So I think that was true for many of the earliest Church of God Seventh Day folks who became RLDS. They made that continuity. Well, I know that because I've talked to others who said something very similar. Wenceslao de Guzman, another person I talked to who's from this very early era, baptized in the late 60s, had a very similar idea too about what it was to be part of the Church of God Seventh Day and then later the RLDS Church in this era.
So when we look at kind of the story of how this developed in the Philippines, it really resonates with those of us who are kind of fixated on the early church history of the 1830s and early 1840s in the United States, because similar happenings took place where people who were leaders in churches and had either large congregations or followers came and visited with the leaders of this fledgling Restoration Church and then somehow joined and brought all their people with them. So this is not a new happening.
It does resonate in that way. So it's like the patterns of conversion that are patterns that oftentimes replicate in some ways kinship in the early restoration are certainly the case in the early Philippines, where the Church of God Seventh Day in many ways was an extended kinships kind of network between two large families, the De Guzmans and the Cabitas. And almost everyone in the Church of God Seventh Day was related to those two families. And then we look at the community of Christ today, it's an exaggeration to say everyone's related to the Cabitas and the De Guzmans, but many people are. So it kind of replicates these kinship systems. I think too that there's an interesting kind of, I don't know how far we can go with this idea, but we look at early restoration, there's several historians have established that there's a tradition of early Latter-day Saints came mostly out of nonconformist traditions in the UK and in the United States and had nonconformist ancestors. That's why so many conversions were made in a certain area, the northwest of Britain, this nonconformist area, rather than the southeast where there almost no conversions happened. And the fact that there were already established networks of relatives in the US and the UK that, the John Taylor and others, had these relationships in Canada and the UK. But I think we can also see that in terms of if you're already part of a non-majority church in the Philippines, you're not Catholic. You're in some ways part of a non-conformist group in that way, especially if you're part of either Jehovah's Witnesses or Adventists in this era. And that's true of the folks that became Community of Christ in the 1960s in the Philippines.
So as we go from the 1966 kind of official establishment and the baptisms that took place of this early group of folks, where did it kind of go from there? Who else participated? Were there other indigenous leaders that developed that were highly influential? Were there other voices in the states and the church leadership that assisted? Kind of how did that begin to grow then as we moved into the 1970s and 80s?
So it's really a relationship between partially Filipino leaders and American service personnel who are there in the Philippines, and then occasional support from World Church that will come through World Church ministers from places like who are based in Japan or have Asia Pacific as their field, who will visit several times a year. But mainly the bulk of the members come through the existing Church of God Seventh Day network. Not everyone who is Church of God Seventh Day becomes RLDS, but a good majority do. Some folks join other Adventist groups, Church of God Seventh Day kind of more schismatic groups, Yahwehists, for instance, which is like they're so small. They're in the U.S. and they're in the Philippines, both. But by and large, many of them do become church Community in Christ or RLDS who are part of Church of God Seventh Day. That means, for instance, that Alfredo de Guzman becomes a member of it. And if today the church in the Philippines is about 10, 11 congregations, and it was about, by the end of the 70s, about 10 or 11 congregations. It's about the same size. I mean, some congregations are no longer, some congregations have come into being since then. But in the East, most of the folks in the East of Luzon who are Community of Christ are somehow either related to the De Guzmans or converted by the De Guzmans. So, and then in the West, which is like Binalonan and congregations in that area, are either related to the Cabitas or were converted by the Cabitas. So there's kind of like two zones for the church. And so the De Guzmans, it's a very large family in the 1960s. And Alfredo de Guzman is the oldest or the spiritual leader of the family. And he has like 9 siblings and they have families. And they come into the church and there are multiple congregations in the East as well as in the West with the Cabitas. So that's basically how that happens. Beyond that, you have small congregations like in that are outside things like Clark Air Force Base, mm-hmm. That are a mix of both U.S. military personnel who are RLDS, and Filipinos who oftentimes work at the base and meet these RLDS service personnel and then begin worshiping in their small congregation. Those congregations, many of them have closed now because military personnel from the U.S., I mean, first of all, there's no longer a draft. And the military presence post-1990s is far smaller in the Philippines than it was pre-1990s. So it means there are no longer American military personnel basically in the Philippines in any major way. So they really couldn't sustain a congregation. And then once American military personnel were gone, you had Filipinos who were part of the congregation. They went for several years and they got support from what would become the Mission Center staff as well. But after a while, they couldn't make it. They were too small. That's a little, those are the two kinds of like kinds of congregations that will develop in the Philippines.
So both of those develop through relationships, personal relationships with people, either family relationships, neighbor relationships, or military relationships that develop. Yeah. Okay. That's helpful. So I want to ask a couple of questions about how the church responded, the body of the church responded to the expansion in the Philippines. And so I have kind of a broad question, and that was, how did the U.S. church kind of respond in that way? India, the Philippines, a few other nations, this was new for the church in the 1960s. As we began our global expansion. And we have bumps in the road when we do things differently in the church, just like everybody else does. So what was the response?
So I think if we talk about the church's expansion in India, there's a direct response in terms of controversy related to the limited practice by Sora folks of polygamy. That makes the World Conference, you know, in the 1970 and 72. The Philippines doesn't have the same kind of like impact in the sense of like there's a controversy in the Philippines that then the rest of the world church discusses and argues about. But what it does have that makes it extraordinarily significant, I think, is that within the Philippines, you have the first RLDS NGO develops in the 1970s. And I think one of the markers of post-World War II denominations in America are denominationally affiliated NGOs and denominational affiliated NGOs that have global reach. And that's true of the liberal ecumenical churches. It's true of the conservative evangelical churches. It was not true of any Mormon church in any sense or any Restoration Tradition church in any sense until the RLDS Church established an NGO in the Philippines in 1972. And so that was an NGO that would later be called Community One Resources Development, or CORD. And following that, in the United States, was developed an NGO called Outreach International, which helped raise money to then fund projects that CORD did within the Philippines, for instance. And so NGOs are really important for any number of reasons, but one of the reasons why NGOs are important is it marks a new kind of understanding of what is Christian mission. It's really interesting when you kind of track the use of words, how they change over time. Today, when folks in Community Christ talk about mission, they're not really talking about as much folks going out and converting people. They mean by mission about God's work in the world. And that's in a broad sense of like being part of God's work in the world, that God's work already exists and how do we respond to God's work in the world? That's a very different understanding than saying like mission means going out and converting your neighbor. Protestant churches in the 1960s and Catholics that were part of coming out of Vatican II, who are kind of more on the, I'd say, more the progressive side of Catholicism, began articulating mission in those terms. And we can see how that also begins to come into the language of RLDS folks in the 1960s, especially in the 1970s, they begin thinking about that, of what mission means. So NGOs are part of that shift, but what is it to be part of God's work in the world, God's presence in the world? So humanitarian missions or humanitarian aid or humanitarian organizations are part of that. And along with that comes a kind of focus on, well, what are we here for in the first place as a church? Why do we exist? An NGO is one response to that about, and along with that language of friendship and partnership becomes much more present in RLDS publications in the 60s and 70s. So thinking less of there are these poor people that need our help, or there are people who we can partner together with. Later on, the language will be accompaniment. But we're seeing that shift happening through structures. Structures are things like, I'm going to argue, NGOs. So I think we look at Herald articles from the 70s. There's a lot of Herald articles that talk about global friendships. That is part of an earlier movement among Protestant Christians in the global missions movements in the 20s, 30s, 40s that talk about global friendships, a reorientation of like, oh, we've got something to give to other people, or maybe we can share. Maybe Christ makes us friends. Maybe Christ breaks down the walls. That's a popular Protestant hymn that RLDS sing to, In Christ There Is No East Nor West. That's sung at Sakine's baptism in 55, I think. Well, that kind of reflects a reorientation too of what does it mean to be the church and be aligned with God's mission in the world. NGOs are part of that.
You can see the change in the language of the church when you look at hymnody that's not only sung in the church after the global expansion, but also the hymnody, the texts that were written by RLDS and the Community of Christ folks begins to reflect this different understanding of mission. So we talked a little bit about Apostle Sakine. He was from Japan. He was Japanese. And we are talking about the Philippines. And so we would not be doing it justice if we didn't talk about the reality of some leftover animosity between Japan and the Philippines and the people of the Philippines and what happened in World War II, which did affect Apostle Sakine. So what can you share with us about that?
Well, I wondered about that when I interviewed some of the older church members in the Philippines. I don't know if I can point to any particular stories about that, but what did surprise me was that of the folks who were in northern Luzon who lived through the occupation, they by and large did not see Japanese soldiers as enemies. They had friendly relationships with individual Japanese soldiers. And at least in these rural areas, that they didn't like the occupation, but they didn't have negative relationships with Japanese soldiers. They were worried about war and about fighting and how they could get caught in the crossfire of that fighting. But they didn't have any... At least I didn't interview anyone that had a violent experience with that. Now, they could have, but they, at least in their own localized experience, they didn't. So I don't know the answer to say how that then would impact Sakine's experience. Maybe you know a bit more about this than I do. I'd love to hear about it, actually.
So I don't know. I know that people that worked with him, including my spouse, share that he had talked about some maybe it was more trepidation that he first had. And he was the first non-white apostle that we had. And this was the 1980s. This is before we really started to talk about race and color openly in the life of the church. So exploring that for any of us with an interest in history would be an excellent sequel to this interview, not just for Sakine, but for others.
Yeah, because I know from interviews with older church members who knew Sakine, their impression is that they liked him as an apostle. They thought he was a good administrator. And why I think that's significant is because, well, they didn't always have these same people I interviewed didn't always have the same opinion of everyone. So as an administrator, I think that's what's significant that they would say that, because I think if they had a negative experience with him, they would have said that too.
Yes, we are free to say that in Community of Christ. We don't seem to hesitate with that, do we?
Yeah.
Well, good. I'm glad that that's a global reality, not just a localized one. Okay. So now let's switch to just who we are kind of as a people. So how has the church in the Philippines and what happened there, how it was established and how it's gone forward, how has it informed our greater kind of journey as a denomination, as a people, as a community? What would you consider the greatest contributions, perhaps, or how the church in the Philippines has informed us going forward?
Well, I think I would point to say that the NGO Corps, which was formed in the Philippines, which had both a Filipinos on the board and then Americans on the board, and was mainly run by church members in the Philippines, that has impacted in terms of like a global community of Christ. Beyond that, I mean, honestly, folks that work now for Outreach Philippines International, OPI, which is kind of, there's all these kinds of interlocking affiliations with that. They historically been greatly involved with development projects in India and in other places in Southeast Asia. So that has kind of impacted Community Christ's outreach in all of those places, and Community Christ's presence in all those places, and what it means to align oneself with Christ's mission in the world. But beyond that, circumstances have meant since the post-1990s that 10% of Filipinos work abroad. This is a result in part of the, you might want to call it, neoliberal policies of deregulation and austerity measures that affect many countries. And in the Philippines, it meant that a lot of folks could no longer find jobs, even with college educations. So it was easier in the 80s as opposed to the post-90s with neoliberal kind of economic policies put in place. As a result, then many Filipinos have immigrated abroad for spans of, usually it's about 2 years before coming home, for 2 weeks only, usually, which is a long time to be away from your family. It does mean that folks have gone abroad for jobs. And it sometimes that means that Filipino Community Christ members who then go abroad, sometimes that means they have no place to worship with its Community of Christ. And they sometimes then find affiliation with other groups like Methodists and things like that. That other times it has meant that folks have formed congregations where they end up living. And sometimes that ends up being a congregation that includes Community of Christ members who are also from other places, who are living in that place at the time, like in Spain, where you have Community of Christ members from the Philippines and from Honduras who are worshiping together, along with folks from Spain. So that's in small congregations. And in that case, those can even be second, third generation Community of Christ members in all those instances, with new Spanish members, basically. So that's also kind of illustrates this a larger truth about people in a globalized world, and globalized markets often have to move around. Sometimes that's forced migration, sometimes it's chosen migration, but people are moving. And we see that too with Community Christ members from the Philippines who live in Germany or live in Spain or live in Toronto or live in Los Angeles and are sometimes part of congregations in Toronto that are Community Christ or Los Angeles, as well as starting new congregations in places like Madrid. So that is while the absolute number of people that's true for is small, it still illustrates a larger kind of global trend, not just for thinking about people and nationalities and nation states and what that means for people having to move for jobs, but also what we're seeing in global Christianity in general, of people on the move, where you have Congolese congregations in London. That's true for Community Christ. That's true for many denominations across the world. So I think that's part of the story of Community Christ in the Philippines.
So of the different aspects of the church in the Philippines from your study, what did you find most interesting personally?
It'd be a huge tangential story, but I found most interesting the story of there's a congregation in the late 60s in a place called Dingading, which is a small mountainous village in Isabela province in the island of Luzon. And they were caught in an insurgency between the New People's Army, which is the military wing of the Communist Party, and the Filipino Army. They were evacuated by the government, forced to evacuate, actually, forced to leave their homes. And they started a new congregation in Simiban. And out of that, the first NGO, CORD, was created. It was created to resettle them, actually, give them some land, help retrain them from raising mountain crops to lowland crops, and give them a new chance on life after they'd lost everything. So the story, that was a fascinating story. I knew about it, but talking to people, interviewing people who experienced it, there were new stories I never heard and new stories that people even who knew people hadn't heard, because people don't always talk about their stories, right?
Right.
So, I mean, it included stories, pretty harrowing stories too, in the time of the insurgency, where one church member actually was recruited by the NPA and basically had to work for them, and eventually left, but he didn't really have a choice in this. Yeah. Yeah. And then other church members who were basically forced by the government to be part of basically like militia forces that guarded checkpoints. They didn't want to do that either because they were afraid they were going to get killed by the NPA. They were farmers. So it was a very difficult time for that congregation. People's lives were, people were killed. Mm-hmm. Not in the congregation, but people knew were killed. Mm-hmm. In the course of this insurgency. So I found that story really interesting, and it brought together all kinds of things like Cold War politics. The Marcos government, of course, was supported by the U.S. It was a dictatorship. He declared martial law. That's why the NPA was reacting. I mean, there's this bigger picture that then you have in this very small village that this is playing out in. And then out of that comes this kind of new thing, a new chance for this congregation. And out of it is also created an RLDS NGO, or the very first church NGO. So that to me was kind of a fascinating story.
A good lesson for us too, to remember that when we read what's happening in the world, when we watch the news or read in the news, we tend to think at the level of nations what's happening, but we forget sometimes that we have very real human stories taking place, many of them with whom we are connected, and we don't even realize it.
Yeah.
So you have been part of Community of Christ history for some time, and you serve now as part of the church history team. How has your study into Community of Christ history, particularly in the area of global expansion, kind of shaped your own discipleship?
Okay, I guess this will be honest with a confession here. I think before I studied Community Christ abroad, I slightly bought into a story which is a problematic story. And the problematic story goes like this. Like, are groups really Community Christ outside of the old Community Christ heritage areas, Australia, French Polynesia, you know, United States, Canada? I kind of bought into that story of like, well, this is affiliation for different reasons. And partially that's true. But going to India, meeting people, talking with them, realizing this has been part of the tradition for generations, going to the Philippines the same way, I think knowing people and knowing their stories and their lives, I think shows that that story itself is a really problematic story. It defines community of Christ on the terms of my own experience and doesn't allow that to take into account other people's experiences, which are very different than my own, but their affiliational identity is just as important to them as it is to me. So it decenters my experience from judging what is community of Christ. So that's what it's done for me, at least.
So what are some things that we can incorporate as a people into our global discipleship from this? How can we translate that learning for you into something that we can incorporate as a body?
That's a great question. That's a hard question.
It is a hard question, but I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, gosh, relationships change us and change is hard, but it changed the life of these communities in the Philippines. It changed families. It changed international relationships. It changed the perspective of the church. It changed you. So how does it change us?
Well, one thing I can say is that across the world, I think we're all aware of a kind of resurgence of ethno-nationalism. That's true in the Philippines. It's true in India. It's true in the United States. It's true in Hungary. It's true in Great Britain. It's true in Germany, France, name it. It's true. Ethno-nationalism is a thing. One thing that global denominations like Community of Christ can do is show why ethno-nationalism can serve as an antidote, if you will, to the kinds of tendencies that ethno-nationalism fosters, to give people a horizon for who is a subject, not just an object that I can act upon and or something that I can destroy or use or whatever, but it creates a world in which there are subjects beyond our own nation, like a world of people. I mean subject, I mean like people with lives that we're connected to. And it makes, it broadens that world to go beyond just national forms of affiliation and affinity. And that seems so simple, but I think it's really true. It does give you a different horizon. And with a social imaginary in which you literally imagine yourself to be part of a larger community combats a social imaginary that's just bound by the nation state, which can be genocidal, literally, and has been in the past. So genocidal even to people within the nation state, they don't fit the certain boundaries of what that means to be part of that nation in terms of that definition. So I think communities, Christianity at its best, can transcend those kinds of divisions, transcend that kind of like those kind of limitations on human community, which can be extraordinarily violent. That doesn't mean that expanded human communities can't be violent too, but I mean it can be a countervailing force to that, is what I'm saying. And I guess the short answer to say is like, if we listen to the stories of others, we can be part of that countervailing force too. If we see others, their welfare is part of our own welfare, then we can work for policies too within our nation states that do prioritize more than just ourselves too.
Well, you said it was a hard question, but you offered a thoughtful and well-articulated response. So thank you for that. So before we bring our conversation to a close, are there any last tidbits that you didn't share that you'd like to, or last thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners today?
Well, so I mean, maybe I just wanted to say too that the church in the Philippines, I narrated its kind of Adventist origins. It kept on evolving after that. And so I'd say today, the Community of Christ in the Philippines, while these are rural congregations still, some are in towns that have grown up a little bit larger. They're like Blue Springs, Missouri size now, some of those towns. At the same time, the Community of Christ in the Philippines would be probably considered one of the more progressive denominations in the Philippines. The denominational leaders have attended some of the most progressive denominational seminary in the Philippines, the United Church of Christ in the Philippines, their seminary. So I just want to say too that no group ever stays the same. That's true of the church within the United States. That's true of the church in Australia. It's true of the church in the Philippines. And so that story is continuing to evolve over time too, with the church in the Philippines as well.
Thanks so much for that, David, and for joining with us today. I know you're back teaching again, and so taking time out to be with us was a very gracious thing to do. For our listeners, you can find David's lecture and the others from the summer series at historicsitesfoundation.org. And you can reach David and the rest of the church history team at historian@seaofchrist.org. And finally, if you would like to learn more about the NGO that David was talking about, kind of the parent organization, Outreach International, you can find them at outreachinternational.org. This has been Cup of Joe, part of the Project Zion podcast. I'm Karen Peter. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.